talk about that in a moment. So pairing heap. You can find it in the archive of formal proofs, but what is it? The idea is that a pairing heap is either empty, or it's a heap with an element at the root and a whole list of heaps below it. So it always looks like this. Some element A, and then a whole list of heaps below it. And the invariant is that clearly, because it's a heap, the element must be the smallest element. So the invariant is the empty heap is always a heap. And if you have a heap like that with an element x at the top and some heaps below, then for all the elements in the heaps, for all the heaps below, at the root you must have a larger element than the element at the root of that heap, and recursively everything below must also be a pairing heap. So that means then in turn here that element must also be the largest element, the smallest element at the root. And so set heap is an auxiliary function that from a heap collects all the root elements recursively, and it says that here this root is smaller than all the other root elements below in the heaps further down and even further down. And for complexity theoretic considerations, the empty heap should not occur except once at the very top. Because in principle, you could have a heap with some element and then lots of empty heaps below, but that would invalidate some of the complexity proofs. How do we insert in such a heap? We, as often, merge the heap with a singleton heap that contains only the element x that you're inserting and nothing below, the empty list of heaps below. And how do we merge two heaps? Well, if one of them ends empty, you get the other one. And in the case of merging two non-empty heaps, this is the definition. So we have, you merge a heap X, which contains the element and the list of heaps below, and the heap Y, element and list of heaps below. Then if X is less than Y, then of course X must come to the root, and you simply take the other heap, the heap Y, and put it in front of the heaps of the X component. So, concrete example, if you have merge of heap with 5 at the top, and then the list of heaps A below, and 7 at the top, and then the list B, then the merge will put the 5 at the top and below you will have a longer list that starts out with this heap. So the first element will be this heap with 7 and the B below, and then it's followed by the A list. So that's what's happening. So it's a cheap operation. It's similar to the link function for the binomial heaps. That leaves the delmin function. Clearly, you can't delete anything from an empty heap, it stays empty. And this is the crucial idea of the pairing heap. How do we delete an element which has lots of heaps below? you start merging those heaps.
So in the end, what's going to happen
is the following. Here, this looks a bit complicated. This is intentionally designed this way to simplify the complexity analysis. But I will give you the end effect without, for a moment, ignoring that there will be two passes to it. So the end effect is the following. So if you have a list of heaps, and how you merge them, what you do is you start at the end. You first merge them in a binary fashion. So you get new heaps by just merging them in pairs. And now, for reasons that I don't really have a good intuitive explanation, you don't do it in pairs again, but now you do it in list-like fashion. So all of these are merge nodes, that you call the merge function, and you see there's a first pass through it where you just merge the pairs that are next to each other, and then there's a second pass where you keep on merging, in some sense, from the back. You keep on merging those merged pairs one after the other into the heap.
So this is what pass one does. If there's at most one heap, there's nothing to do. But if there are two heaps, you merge them, and then you merge them pairwise again. So that's the pass one would produce
this first level.
And then pass two, if it's empty, there's nothing to do. If you have one more heap, then you recursively merge all the heaps in HS, and then you merge that one heap into it.
So this is what happens here this is the end of the end result of pass two.
And you can fuse them, you can write one function. This is the merge pairs function, which may or may not be more intuitive, but it's certainly a little bit more efficient because you just need one pass through the list of heaps. But the picture remains the same, and that's what you should keep in mind. The functional correctness proof of all of this is pretty straightforward. I don't want to go into it. And I'm not going into the complexity analysis either, because it is rather, I mean, not into the details of the complexity analysis, because it is quite complex. But I will at least indicate how it's done. So this is a data structure with amortized analysis again. The analysis can be unified, it's a bit more uniform, if you don't have this alternation of the heap structure and the list structure. So if you flatten this, then it becomes a bit simpler, and you view it as a binary tree, and this is the function that converts a list of heaps into a binary tree. So if it's the empty list, it's the empty tree. And if it's a list that starts with a heap and then continues, then you make it a binary tree where you have here you convert all the heaps on the of the first element, and here you convert the rest of the heap list, and that gives you a binary tree. And the conversion of a heap into a tree, well, it's the empty heap, you get the empty tree, and if it's a heap with an element and a list, then you get a binary tree where the empty the right part is simply empty, and this function here that runs over a whole list of heaps that creates the left part. And then it turns out you can use exactly the same potential function as for splay trees.
If you remember, we were summing up binary logarithms of sizes all over the tree. Let's just go back. I think we should have display trees here. Yes. So this was the function that walked over the tree and summed up the potential of all the nodes. And what's the potential of a node? It's the binary logarithm of the size of the node plus one. So that's the one we're using here.
But that's all I'm going to say about it, because the actual analysis and showing that that insert, delete, min, and merge all have logarithmic amortized analysis is simply quite lengthy, and I don't think it really conveys more insight. And this is more or less the proofs that you find in the original paper that this is based on, except the original paper is for an imperative implementation, so it's all a bit more involved. But then people start to analyze this a bit further and found that these bounds are not tight. It's not the case that you can improve the amortized analysis and get better bounds for some of the operations. And so this is what you can find in the literature, that insert and merge are actually O of 1, and only del min is logarithmic. But this is really quite complicated, these analyses, and I have not been tempted to verify them. And the exact complexity is really still open. So, yeah, and there you find the complexity analysis. So I guess that's all I wanted to say about pairing heaps. So from what I've read in the literature, it seems to be one of the fastest but only amortized complexity heap implementations around. And it was invented by these people, Fredman, Sedgwick. Of course, he's a big algorithms person, Slita and Tarchin, who invented these other self-organizing data structures. And then they went on and invented the pairing heap. And the functional version that I've been showing you, that's due to Okazaki in his nice book. We've been talking a lot about tree data structures, and we in the sense of the my research group and students have verified many further data structures and algorithms. Here's just an impression of what has been done. So, for example, more trees, Huffman trees, they are very nice. These are coding trees where you're trying to find frequency distribution of characters in a text. You want to find binary coding sequences that can compress the text into a minimal amount of space. And so what you do is you give the frequently occurring characters short codes, and the less frequently occurring characters, you give them long codes. And these short codes compress the text, and the infrequently occurring long codes don't matter so much. And so the way to construct these trees is called the Huffman tree or Huffman algorithm, and it goes back to, I believe, some kind of a term project by a student at MIT, and he then invented something that his professors hadn't expected him to invent. It was verified by a PhD student of mine in Isabel later on. And you can see there's quite a discrepancy between the invention and the first really machine-checked formal proof. Finger trees, I don't want to go into there, some quite versatile but a bit tricky functional data structure. There are a number of verifications of those. But you can do more than just trees. You can also do graphs. So here's a sample of graph algorithms that we've verified. Of course, Floyd Warshall, again, very old, from the early 60s. And the first really full verification is actually quite recent. Many authors, including, interestingly enough, the textbook, the Corman textbook, make a simplifying assumption that if you look into the proof, this simplifying assumption simplifies the proof considerably. And these people, Wilmer and Damisch, didn't make that assumption. Shortest path, of course, lots of verifications of that. So this is just an early one, but there are other theorem provers and other verifications around, but it's also a very early algorithm. Maximum flow, this is about a network, a graph, where you have capacities along the edges and you want to find what is the maximum flow you can push through the network given the limitations by the capacities. So this could be a road network or transportation network, whatever you can think of. And it's actually quite a bit tricky algorithm, and goes back to Ford Falkerson. In the context of operations research, where you try to optimize throughput in some network, and the verification, really, this is the first one, is by Lamich and a student a few years ago. Strongly connected components, one of the basic graph algorithms, goes back to Tarchin in the 70s, and as far as I know, the first verification was by somebody in a joint project, and Peter Lamich then verified a simpler algorithm by Garbov. And of course you can't verify graph algorithms without verifying minimum spanning tree. There are two well-known ones, Kruskal's algorithm and Prim's algorithm, interestingly enough, published 1 year apart only. I have no idea about the history. I do wonder whether Prim was motivated by reading Kruskal's paper to invent an alternative approach to it. I just don't know. I've never looked at the paper. I assume Prim cites Kruskal, but even that I don't know. And that is fairly recent work on verifications of Kruskal and Prim's algorithm. So this is just a sort of in the small algorithm verifications. In the large, one of the bigger project we've carried out is a spin-like LTL model checker. What is spin? Spin is a model checker that takes the description of a system in something called Promila protocol modeling language, and takes a linear time logic formula and checks whether this finite state system, it has to be satisfies the formula. And with Javier Esparza and some co-authors, we verified a version of spin that was really completely defined in Isabel. Of course, it doesn't run as quickly as the official spin runs. It runs sort of between, if you're lucky, it's 10 times slower. If you're unlucky, it's 100 times slower. It's some internet. But it's not meant to, on the day-to-day basis, you're not meant to use it. It's something you would do at the end of the project. If you are not quite sure that spin does the right thing, you can then have a last check with your verified model checker. And the whole thing isn't completely academic in the sense that I think it was this year or last year, I'm not quite sure, somebody published a paper that showed that with certain parameters, spin gives you the wrong result. There's actually a very deep problem there, and the problem is that spin does something called partial order reduction, which means if you have something like a diamond, then it figures out, oh, you don't have to go both ways, it suffices to go one way, or something like that. So you can cut out, you can use symmetries to reduce the amount of checking that you do, the amount of exploration of the graph. And I've seen examples of this where people use symmetries to cut down on some search space and they make a mistake and they miss out part of the search space because it is really quite tricky. And
Peter Lammich, together with somebody who's not on that author list because it's a bit later, 2015 I think that started, Julian Brunner. Julian Brunner's master's thesis was to verify one of the algorithms used in SPIN for partial order reduction by Doron Pellet. It's a well-known algorithm in the literature, and he didn't manage to verify it. And there was one lemma that he couldn't prove, and he did find a counterexample to the lemma, so the lemma was definitely wrong. But of course, it doesn't mean that there isn't another proof of that algorithm. It's just that this proof that the author gave just doesn't work because one of the supporting lemmas was wrong. He got in touch with Doron Pellet, who first seemed interested and then never really replied to the emails. So we didn't quite know what was going on there. And somebody else in the US had already a few years earlier got the impression that there's something problematic about this algorithm. And based on Julian's, Julian published a paper saying, well, there's this lemma we can't prove, but maybe the whole algorithm is right. He went back and he actually found a counterexample. So Doron Pellet's algorithm is incorrect. And SPIN implements that algorithm. And if you switch on that particular implementation in SPIN, then you can get an unsoundness. So that's why I'm saying it's not a completely academic exercise to verify something that's supposed to give you more trust in your system. Yes, and we also, that's some nice work of, I think 2 years back, a dynamic programming. That's one of the cornerstones of efficient algorithms. I don't need to explain to you, I hope. What we do here in this context, we start with a recursive function, and then we automatically translate it to a memorized version where the recursive calls are stored in some table, or the results of the recursive calls are stored in some table. So if you get from two different points, you get the same call. It's not computed again, but it's retrieved from the table, and you get not just this new function, it might do anything, but you actually get automatically a correctness theorem that says that this memorized version of the function does produce the same result as the original version. And there are numerous applications. For example, if you want to construct an optimal binary search tree, you have the frequencies, how often a certain a key is searched for, and then you want to build a search tree which is optimal with respect to that frequency. So the frequency searched keys, of course, should go to the top of the tree, and the less frequently searched further to down. That is something you can do with dynamic programming. In fact, the first algorithm for that optimal binary search tree construction is a cubic algorithm, and then Don Knuth looked at it very carefully and found, and no, it doesn't need to be cubic, it's quadratic. So he then gave a quadratic one. Both of them are based on dynamic programming, but quadratic is better than cubic. And there's a lot of there's a certain amount of infrastructure how to develop algorithms. So Peter Lammich, you can tell he was on a lot of verifications, his name. He was a postdoc in my group until this March and is now in Manchester at the university. And he believes strongly in
developing your algorithms top down. So you start with some functional definition of the algorithm, and then you refine it, for example, by replacing sets by lists or by search trees or something, and you even go down to an imperative level where you use a framework that I haven't talked about here at all, where you can actually define imperative algorithms. So, yes, so this is what his refinement framework supports. Now, this the idea, of course, goes back to the 70s. People like Tony Hoare would strongly advocate stepwise refinement of programs, but Peter really has put a lot of work in making it work in the sense of having a support environment that supports you in this development process. And most of this you can find in the archive of formal proofs. And this is really the end of the well-prepared material. Now, I had this idea a few days ago. I thought, why don't I do the following? I set myself some task, which I have never really thought about very well, and then together we try to formalize it here and prove something about it. And then I was kind of a little bit worried how well this would work, and so I don't come here unprepared, but instead I sat down a few days ago and started, and then I had to think and restart and think, and maybe all of us together would have done it very quickly, but I couldn't do it quickly, and I was so it took me a couple of iterations, and it just showed me that it typically doesn't work if you come to some new task unprepared, and then in about an hour or even less you achieve some reasonable definitions and proofs. So I do have a prepared version, but I would still like to go through it with you, not through what I've prepared, but what we come up with interactively in a discussion. And the topic are quad trees. And they appear extremely simple, and in the end they are simple, but somehow I managed to, it took me a couple of iterations before I came up with something that I was happy with. So in case you're not familiar with quad trees, here is the usual picture. So they're actually endless variations of these geometric trees, and these are called region quad trees. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to store an image, a pixel image, in compressed form. And the compression idea is that, let's say we have this, this is the image. And let's assume these are all black and the rest is white. And the idea, the compression only works if you have, as you typically have in pictures, contiguous areas that are all black or all white, or all of the same color, or something like that. If you have random dots, then this is not going to give you a good compression. And what you now do is you subdivide your picture into four quadrants, and you do that recursively, and when one of the quadrants, all the pixels inside have the same color, then you don't need to subdivide it further, but you just say, this is the end, and here everything is black or everything is white. So you start out with this subdivision. I think I should maybe try a different color, but I don't have a different color. Right. Usually some people are kind enough to leave other chalks around, but not today. Okay. So the corresponding data structure is a tree. We start here. And obviously, not all of the pixels have the same color, so you have to subdivide it into four quadrants. And you have to have some ordering on the quadrants. So let's assume the ordering is like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. So first child, second child, third child, fourth child. And then you can see this quadrant and this quadrant are all white. So you can put a leaf node there. And this one is all black. Hang on, I think I'm getting confused here. 1, 2, no. This is 0, 1, 2 is mixed, 3 is all ones, and 4 is 0. And here you have again a subdivision into the first two quadrants are 0 and the other two are 1.
So I think this is pretty intuitive, just from a pictorial angle.
You should also now understand that you need to somehow, that the tree doesn't really tell you the size of the area. So in some sense, you need to store or carry around with you which level, what the size really is. So here we are at level two, which means 2 to the 2 times 2 to the 2. This is the area that we're describing, 4 by 4 pixels. And then of course here it must be 2 to the 1 by 2 to the 1, and here it's 2 to the 0 by 2 to the 0. So this is level 2, 1, and 0. And you could store that, and some implementations do that, store the level in the tree, but really it suffices that you know what the level is. And so another way is you could wrap up this data structure in some wrapper that tells you like what is the depth and what is maybe the location if you don't want the origin to be fixed there. So we ignore all of that. We just have this data structure, but then we do need the numeric information, what the level is that we're starting with. And it's not necessarily the height, because you could just have, if you have a big picture with all the white in it, then you just have a leaf node that says everything is white, but it doesn't tell you how big the picture was that you came from. So somehow this size information has to be there as well in some form or another. So that's all I wanted to say as an introductory remark. And now I would like to, in cooperation with you, in fact, you should mostly do it because I already know where we're heading, but it would be nice if you could do all the work here. I don't think we need this anymore. So where are we? Oh, this is TTT. Yeah. What is this? No, this is not it. Then must be here. Yes. No, we're not going to do quad trees for the simple reason that they have 4 subtrees, but we're just going to do it in a one-dimensional way. So we just have a line of pixels, and we want to compress that by cutting the line into 2 parts and recording whether one part is all 0 or all 1. So this is the data type that I'm starting with. A binary tree, which either says I'm a leaf and everything is, well, either true or false, 0, 1, black, white, or I'm a node and I'm subdividing my line into 2 halves. And so what I started out with, and this is what I would like to start out with you, is a function that maps such a recursive data type into a list of points, because in the end you're supposed to represent that as pixels, so there should be a function, the abstraction function, that maps, I don't know how you want to call it, but it maps a binary tree to a list of, well, we're just in one direction, it's just a set, a set of natural numbers. That's the abstract thing that this is supposed to represent. So I'll start out with asking you what should be points of the leaf situation. You have a leaf with a Boolean inside.
And I'm not necessarily giving you the complete information. There may be something wrong with this that we have to correct.
Yes. So the abstraction function does need another natural number that tells you at what level you are. Call that n. Right. So now let's try again. Partial solutions are also possible. I don't believe this. There is one easy case here. Yeah? Right, okay. Right. Yeah. So this is the easy case. So what is it if it's true? Well, then here it's a whole quadrant, but we're now in the simpler situation that we have a line, so it's a whole line segment from where to where. That of course, has to, you have to have some convention, and the convention should be this one. So here is the origin. So here's 0, 0. And that's the convention you should start from. So it should be a set of points from 0 to where? And this is the notation. And we just need to fill in the upper bound. That covers the base case. Of course, we are implicitly making the assumption now that the n has the right value, and that it has exactly the values that I wrote down here. But this is the, I think, the canonical choice to make. The situation that we're subdividing essentially just the line into two halves, and so we probably have to apply the abstraction function recursively to the two subtrees and then do something. So that seems like a good starting point. So now, any suggestion of yours what we should do with these two sets? Yep. And then what you do with, after you've shifted them, how do you combine the two sets? Oh. It's got a name.
Yeah.
Union. So you take a union and you shift this part. So shifting we will express by taking a function and applying it to all the elements in the set, and this is the syntax which I may or may not have introduced. So here we have a function which still needs to be defined, and we apply, this is the back tick is the application of the function to all the elements in the set on the right. And so it'll be a function that takes a point and it shifts the point by something. By how much?
Yeah.
Okay. What do we supply as the level to the recursive functions? N minus 1.
We don't shift by 2 to the power of n, but 2 to the power of n minus 1.
Right. Yeah. Now, it actually simplifies matters a little bit if we do it without, if instead of minus 1 we use the pattern matching. and write successor of n here, because on the left, on the right, everything is minus 1, so it just both for aesthetic purposes and because the proofs become a little bit more streamlined, it doesn't make much of a difference. Let's write it like this. So we assume that the level number that we're using is right for that tree, because if you call points with a level number that's inappropriate, if you would call it with level number 0, for example, for that tree, then this abstraction function doesn't work. But it's fine as it is, no problem. So then I wanted to prove something about it, but I don't think I will go into the proofs now. We might in the end if we get bored with other things, but let's first check that we get some reasonable results for some typical small examples. Well, not sure whether they're typical for some small examples. Let's take a node of leaf false and leaf true. And what should we, and we want all the points this represent. What should we supply as the level? So let's see what comes out. And it's 2, 3. So this is what the tree looks like. And we have said this is at level 2, so this is a 2 by 2, a line of length 2 to the 2, so a line of 4 pixels, and the first half is all zeros, and the second half is all ones, so that means the line that we have is really here, 0, well, these are the, so this is 0, 0, and this is 1, 1, and that's why we get the 2, 3 out as a as the set of points that we're representing, but we could also call it with a different and maybe more appropriate, but that's not clear. The tree itself doesn't really say, so 2 is perfectly fine, but you could also call it with 1, and then it would just be a line consisting of 2 points, and the first point is 0, and the second point is 1, and the second point is at coordinate 1. But you could also, if you blow it up, if you say, oh, I want it, I think this is at level 3, then you get, everything is just magnified. It just increases in, it just doubles in size. So that seems to work somewhat. It is actually correct. Let's look at another one. So we can copy this. And what do we take here? True. Yeah, let's add another level. Is that the one? No. This one. So this is a binary tree where the left is all true and the right is again the subdivision of false and true. And now 3, well, we could do it with 2. That would work. So this is 1, 0, 3. So the 0, 1, I think, must be this part here. Yes, and the 3 is this part. Yeah. So, yep, seems to work. Now, what is a lemma without wanting to prove it now? What if you want to get some more confidence that your definition does the right thing? What is something you might want to prove about it? You might want to prove about, for example, that all the points are in a certain range that you get back. So what should that be? Points of N and T should be a subset of which set of a certain interval from where to where would you expect it? Yep. And this actually does work, but that surprises me a little bit. Why does that surprise me? Can anybody? It surprises me because our function points is underspecified. We don't even know what points does if the level doesn't really fit the tree well, if the level number is too small. And so anything could come out of it. So I think what's happening here is that the automatic quick check doesn't detect this, or rather it will, what happens is a quick check runs test cases, and if a test case simply aborts because of failed pattern matching, then this is not a count, it doesn't count as a counter example. So that's why we don't get a counter example, because you won't be able to prove it like that. Because you just don't know enough about points. So we do need a precondition here. What is the precondition? Just say it in words. We can't actually write it down yet because we don't have enough functions. But what should... There must be some condition on the n. What would you expect the n to be? Or to be limited by in one way or another? Yeah, that's precisely it. Only then is the point function well defined. So we do need a height function. Doesn't matter where we put it. Fun height. Yeah, let's be precise. From binary tree to nut. And then it's exactly this one. And now, of course, quick check can't find any counterexamples either because this one is correct. Now, I tried to prove this and got stuck because I had been thinking and I had written n must be less or equal than the height. And then I couldn't prove it, and yeah, it's only, and then I went away frustrated, and then came back and thought, oh, what rubbish! Yeah. So let's just put a sorry here. Actually, I do wonder. There's also nitpick, which is a very different version of quick check. I mean, it works by set solving. I wonder whether nitpick would have told us that there's a problem with the definition. Now, of course, it won't tell us anything because found no counterexamples. But if we take this away again, Yeah, so Nitpick did find that counterexample. And yeah, you can see if n is zero and the tree is has a node in it, it doesn't really tell. Yeah, there's a funny thing down here which I don't quite know how to interpret that. But Nitpick is in such cases actually better than quick check because of the it checks for undefinedness. Okay, that was just a okay. What else could we be doing? Let's first just define one or two functions on this data type. And one of the advantages of this representation is that you can, for example, easily combine images. Let's just do the union where you want to have all the pixels that are true in at least one of them. Suggestions from the audience. Okay, we can generalize the two leaves situation already a little bit. You don't need two leaves to do something simple. If one leaf, okay, so let's assume we have a leaf here with some Boolean value and some t, arbitrary tree t, then I guess we would have to check what the b is. And if b is true, then that leaf, yep. And if it's false, then T. Yeah. And then you have the same thing with the T and the leaf exchanged. And of course, we have to cater for the union of two nodes. What should the correctness theorem be? Now I expect QuickCheck will again not find any counterexample, but Nitpick might. But I think it'll be again the same counterexample that the n is unconstrained in its value. Where's my? Here it is. Yes, it found a counterexample where the n is zero and the trees are non, at least the second tree is of non-zero height. So that's the same problem. So how should we constrain it here? I think that should be the right one. And now nitpick doesn't find anything anymore, I assume. Tries hard. I think it tries for half a minute or something. Yeah. Okay. So that's nice. Yeah, why not this? How about a function to find whether a certain pixel is set or not? So let's call that get. And it takes, of course, a binary tree and takes a natural number that's supposed to be the address of the pixel that we want to check and gives us back a Boolean. Except that we again need this level business, so we need another. Let me just put in the parentheses to show this is really the right way around for the parameters. So you could really view the get function as a kind of abstraction function that maps a binary tree into a function from indices to Boolean values. You might be tempted to, so that's the right way around. But of course, we need more information about the binary tree, the levels. So let's put the level number in there as well. So it takes two parameters and gives you back this function. But of course, it really takes three parameters. So get n, oops. That if it does that. So if you want to check whether point P is set in that area, well, actually that line segment represented by that leaf, what do we do? Of course, we can do an if-then-else here. If the leaf is false, then of course the point can't be in it. I think I'm being too complicated here. Yes, I'm too complicated. That's a very simple solution. Yeah.
I guess we can just do B.
Yeah.
Then we need to make sure.
Yes, so of here, because we need to know that the N is large enough. Yeah. And then the P really needs to be in the right range. But let's assume that we have given the right N and the right P, then it should indeed just be B. And now we can play the successor trick again here. It is again an if then else, but what do we, which case distinction do we want to make here?
If P is less or equal than 2 to the n, then we search in the left subtree.
Like this? Yep. And otherwise?
Then we need to change the P. N, R, N, P minus 2 to the N.
Right. We could pull out the 2 to the n in a let expression, but let's not do that. So what would the correctness theorem here be? Get NLP, not L, NTP is equal to something else. And it'll be kind of similar to this theorem about the union. Yeah?
So generally speaking, this, I think that the x is in the points of nt, and then we should be able to get nt x.
Yeah, slowly. So this one? Maybe I misunderstood you and was just listening to myself.
No, I said the other way.
Oh, right. But I prefer it this way because it's always the sort of the abstract. The concrete implementation is equal to the abstract one. But we get a counterexample. So we don't even need to look at it. There are a few things that we need to. Set as preconditions, as usual. So what precondition would you assume
for this to work? Yeah?
And P and we still get a counterexample. Maybe we should look at the counterexample, or maybe you have already caught the problem. Yep, so this is the culprit. So the first half is 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. So we can put a less than here. And let's see what happens to the counterexample. It goes away. Excellent. So this seems to work, but of course modulo the fact that quick check doesn't tell us if there's something undefined at some point, of course, it might also not have tried enough test cases, so we don't really know, but it's a good first start. I think we could even get rid of this condition here. Because I think if the P is too large, I think we need both of them. And I hope if I ask nitpick, it won't find any more counterexamples. Yeah, if it takes a while, then. And I would like to finish with a slight generalization of what we've been doing. What we've been doing so far, we have always assumed that the points function, the abstraction function, is given a number that's large enough for the height of the tree. But you can also take the point of view and say, if you give it a smaller number, it should really abstract the tree in the sense that if you have some subtree that it doesn't reach, you simply summarize that subtree. For example, if there's a big subtree with zeros and ones in it with pixels, and the n becomes zero before you go down into it, then you just say, let's take the grayscale of that subtree. So your abstraction function will no longer be a set of points, but it will be, you could say, a function from points to grayscale, I would suggest we make it simply a set of pairs of coordinate or point and grayscale. And what we have up there is a good first start, but we need to modify it. So, and we need to, instead of importing main, which doesn't have real numbers in it, we need to import complex main, because the grayscale will be, rational numbers, but of course we will just use real numbers. So let's call that, image, maybe. And it produces a set of natural numbers and their grayscale. So the base case is similar, but we need to associate a grayscale with all of these points, but that's of course clear that grayscale is just one, because it's really everything is full. So we can express this by taking the Cartesian product with the single set one and call that image. And image here, it's kind of similar, but not quite. We're still in the range where we don't need to go into grayscales, because the n is large enough. But now this part here doesn't work, because the point isn't just a point that we can add something to, but it's a pair of a point and a grayscale. And so we can add the point and leave the grayscale unchanged. I think that should work. There's still something wrong here. What's wrong? so that I could look at the error message, but... Oh, this is not Haskell, this is Isabel, so you can't write that. Set takes a single argument parameter, so what we mean is this one. So that leaves this situation. Of course, the tree will have to be a node, because if it's a leaf, the first line still works. But if it's a node and you have reached depth zero, that means you want to compress it into a single pixel of a certain grayscale. So how do you do that? Why don't we call an auxiliary function to do it? You could do it recursively, but that's kind of... feels a bit too complicated. So let's just call a auxiliary function, produce one point. The point will be the zero and the gray scale of, or the gray value of that tree. So let's define that. Well, that's, of course, just 0 or 1 for a leaf. I may have a mistake here. No? I don't seem to be. No, I think that's okay. So if B, then 1, else 0. What do we do here? So it's just gray left plus gray right divided by 2. And so I guess we should at least look at one example to see if that makes sense. So we want image of a certain tree. Why don't we take that tree that we had further up? Then I don't need to write it down again. Oh, here it is. Yeah. But image needs another parameter. So let's first do the right thing and put a 2 there. Then we should get an image where all the points have, yes, the gray values are all 1 for those points that are in the set. So this is exactly what we had earlier, except that there's also the... Now, what if we make this a 1? Then we're basically saying this subtree should be approximated by a gray value because we're only going down one level. So, and indeed, we have one point, the left subtree at point 0 with gray value 1, and another point, the next one, which is really gray between 0 and 1. And if we were to make it 0, what would we get? Yes. You can think of it, if you take the 1, then essentially what you're doing, you're compressing those 2 points into 1, and that gives you a gray value of 3/4. And that's about as far as I thought about this. I was then trying, I was thinking of generalizing this, because the drawback of this, the advantage and drawback is that we have a representation now that's really only for one dimension. If you want to do quad trees, you have to rewrite the whole code. If you want to do oct trees in three dimensions, you again have to rewrite the code. Can't we do it? Can't we find a generic representation that works for any dimension? And I think we can, but I haven't completely worked this out, so I'll just sketch what I think will work. This is, of course, if your dimension is fixed, this is not going to be more efficient, but at least it gives you the flexibility to change the number of dimensions. I think what I wanted to do is that the coordinates will now be lists of numbers, and the length of the list is the number of dimensions that you have. And what instead, you can think of this cutting into four, you can think of it as an iterated, cutting it first into like two halves and cutting that into two halves again. So I think what we can do is, I think we can represent the number of, and in two different dimensions. So essentially you can do a subdivision that first takes the first dimension, cuts it into two, then the second dimension, cuts it into two, and at any point you can say either there's a leaf, because everything is the same value, or you again subdivide it. And then you have to do that for all dimensions, and at the end you come to the next level. So I think it should be something like this. It's a data type. Call it, I don't know, GT for generalized tree, or KDT. This is actually a terminology taken from the literature, but it's something slightly different, a K-dimensional tree, a KD tree. And what is that? It could be, again, a leaf, maybe of a Boolean value. And now the interesting is, what does the node take? I think it should really take this subdivision tree, at the leaves of which you again have a KD tree, something like this. So let's first spell out the subdivision tree. Call it sub T. And it can either be another leaf, and I have to invent more names. Oops. Leaf and no. A, or a subdivision of two such trees. And this node would probably be a KD tree subtree. It doesn't like that. Oh, those are like this. And similarly here. I think something along those lines would work. This actually gives us something slightly more general, where we could even start by, say, subdividing the x dimension and then decide, this half is already completely the same, so we don't need to do another subdivision. To be honest, I have no idea. I haven't found exactly this, precisely this approach in the literature. So I don't know whether it is vital that you immediately get down to four quadrants, or I don't think it is. But it seems to have, I didn't find precisely this definition. So this really brings us to the end, and you're welcome to continue with this. In fact, some of you are doing the practicum, and I'm just about to add another topic there, namely all these trees. There is quite a lot of variation there in the literature, and we have some of it already, but not others, and you can also use these trees as representations for sparse matrices. So there's another whole application area, and I will add that in case you're interested. Thank you for coming on this last day at this early hour. I always enjoy teaching this course, and I thank you in particular today for being so active and participating in it. And I hope for those of you who continue with the practicum, I look forward to seeing you again. And in any case, best of luck for the exam. Das Problem ist, Sie können, wenn Sie amortisierte Analyse machen und jetzt die tatsächliche Laufzeit von dem Merge nehmen, dann haben Sie an der Stelle, das funktioniert dann nicht, dann kriegen Sie die anderen nicht so billig.
Ah.
Das Merge muss auch was zahlen, damit die anderen billiger werden. Das ist das Problem. Deswegen, also so eine Mischung aus amortisierter und tatsächlicher Laufzeit, das geht nicht.
Ah. Ich hätte eine andere Frage.
Ja.
Ich wäre sehr interessiert vielleicht an einer Bachelorarbeit im Bereich Qualifikation.
Ja.
Können Sie mich da an Sie wenden? Oder?
Das sind Sie bei mir richtig. Sie haben ja wahrscheinlich schon mal unsere Webpages sich angesehen. Da gibt es halt konkrete Vorschläge. Jetzt diese KD-Bäume wären auch ein mögliches Thema. Da müssen wir mal gucken, wenn jetzt jemand aus dem Praktikum die machen will. Ja gut, da könnte man auch sagen, Sie haben die schon jetzt. Das ist also eigentlich, ja. Also das wäre eine Möglichkeit, zum Beispiel diese Bäume weiterzuentwickeln, wo ich ja jetzt gerade erst angefangen habe. Da gibt es zwar auch schon einen Eintrag im Archive of Foreign Proofs über die KD-Bäume, aber da gibt es ganz offensichtlich verschiedene Variationen zu. Und insbesondere diese Idee, diese Repräsentation für dünn besetzte Matrizen zu benutzen, da hat noch niemand irgendwas formalisiert. Mhm. Also das wäre zum Beispiel jetzt spontan ein Thema, was man machen könnte.
Irgendwann vielleicht mal nach der Klausur nochmal BMM melden.
Genau. Ja.
Dann vielen Dank.
Bitte.
Ja.
So, hallo. Ja.
Also ich wollte mal fragen wegen dem anderen Thema.
Ja.
Also wie würde das denn da laufen, wenn ich das mit der Memorization?
Also ich sage es Ihnen ganz ehrlich, ich glaube, das andere Thema ist weniger reizvoll, weil Sie da in was einsteigen, was bereits existiert. Da ist eine gewisse Codebasis da, also nicht Isabel-Formalisierung, sondern wirklich auf der ML-Ebene diese Funktionen, die eben die unmemorisierte Funktion in die memorisierte übersetzen und das Korrektheitstheorem beweisen. Und das ist alles relativ fiddlig, sagen wir mal. Also da kann man schon noch mehr draus machen, als wir draus gemacht haben. Aber ich glaube, für Studenten ist es nicht ganz so attraktiv.
Ja,
das ist meine Vermutung. Und jetzt, es würde mir auch helfen, wenn Sie das machen, aber ich sage Ihnen ganz offen, was ich, Und das ist der Simon Wimmer, der hatte eben ursprünglich dieses Thema betreut und der wäre halt interessiert, das weiterzuentwickeln. Und es ist jetzt fast ein bisschen gemein, dass ich Ihnen davon abrate.
Ja. Ja, dachte ich mir eigentlich auch eher, dass ich was mit den Approximationsalgorithmen mache.
Ich glaube auch, das ist die die Aufgabenstellung, wo man sich nicht so tief in irgendwelche existierenden Details einarbeiten muss und was dann auch schöne, das kann man auch erklären, jemandem, was er gemacht hat, wohingegen man jetzt sagt, ich habe jetzt hier noch da irgendwas verbessert, dann ja, ist nicht ganz so attraktiv.